A study this month showed that some very premature babies can survive if doctors treat them aggressively. This hour, the treatment and ethics of care for premature babies. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, we'll hear from one of the researchers involved in the new study, pediatrician Dr. Edward Bell of the University of Iowa. We'll also discuss the medical implications of preterm care and talk with UI physician ethicist Dr. Loris Kaljian. And we'll hear from an Iowa mother about her ordeal of having a baby at just 23 weeks. Experience with premature birth? Join our conversation. First, this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we'll talk about new developments, a new study about premature babies. It's a study that has documented that a small number of very premature babies are surviving earlier outside the womb than doctors once thought possible. It's a study that's raising questions about how aggressively premature babies should be treated and the implications of that. And joining us for the hour, Dr. Edward Bell, professor of pediatrics at the Steed Family Department of Pediatrics at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Dr. Bell, welcome to our program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And also starting off this hour, Tundi Brady is with us, a resident of the Iowa City area, also the mother of a child born at just 23 weeks. That was about 5 years ago, excuse me. Tundi Brady, welcome to our studio.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start off with your story and then hear from Dr. Bell some more details about this study out earlier this month. Tell us your story. A little more than 5 years ago, Tundi, you were pregnant with twins.
Yes, we were pregnant with twins, and the pregnancy was going along normally, and at about 19 weeks, I went into labor unexpectedly, and the labor was stopped with surgery and medicine. I was put on bed rest for 2.5 weeks. The hope was, of course, to last as long as possible, months, hopefully, but we only made it to 22 weeks and 6 days, and the labor restarted. So back to the hospital I went, and at that point, my husband and I expected that we'd be losing the children because we were told that we would be able to become patients of the university hospital at 23 weeks and 6 days. Because at that point, 6 years ago, if my understanding is correct, viability was considered at 24 weeks. And so right before that, they would start giving injections to me of steroids that would help make the baby's lungs work better.
So your twins were just actually days short of the point of viability, yes.
Exactly, when the labor was imminent. So by the time we arrived at the hospital, at University Hospital, it was just a few hours past midnight. So we made it into the 23rd week. And we fully expected that we were just going to lose our children. We didn't know that there was even a chance or a thought that they could make it.
And the doctor's comments led you to believe that.
Exactly, right. Mm. However, at that time, and Dr. Bell can correct me if I'm wrong, the policy was that if a mother was in the 23rd week, the neonatologists would consult with the parents on what they wanted to do. And so they did come and speak to us, and I don't remember the conversation because that night was very fuzzy, but I do remember the tone wasn't hopeful, that twins born just a hair into the 23rd week with no injections of steroids could make it. And so my husband and I decided that rather than having them be poked and prodded and pricked and dying anyways, we would hold them and just let them have peace for the few minutes that they were alive.
Very difficult decision.
It was. And so a few hours later, our daughter was born, and we did just that. But our son was not born. which was very unusual, but it allowed for them to try again to stop the labor, get me steroids right mm-hmm. away, and 6 days later he was born.
To the first birth here, I understand that the child's name was Beatrice.
Yes.
And Beatrice lived for how long?
I think probably 20 minutes. Her heartbeat, she was still attached to, the umbilical cord was cut at one point, but afterwards the doctor said that the oxygen in that kept her heart going. She never made a sound or took a breath. Her lungs really weren't developed to the point where it could exchange oxygen. So that just wasn't even something she would have been able to do.
You had a chance to hold her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we held her for about an hour, but I don't think she was alive for the whole second half of that.
Okay, so then the second twin stays in the womb. The amniotic sac is broken at this point. It has to be, right?
Hers was.
There are two. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so he is there, and the decision is to keep him there as long as possible?
Yes. And so we just took it day by day. I don't think the expectation was that I would last very long because it's kind of odd. Mm-hmm. But on about day three or four, doctors did come to talk to us because we really didn't understand what the possibilities were. And so then they started talking to us about what the odds were now that I did get steroid injections and as every day passed. And they had to describe that to us. And I think that what the rate of survival was 40% chance at that point. And we didn't even have to think about it. If there was a chance like that, that was absolutely worth it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so tell us what happened after that.
So on day six, labor started for the third time, and I had an emergency C-section. Dexter was scooped up and intubated, and I don't think I saw him at that point. I think it was just such a quick switch, but my husband did, and he was teeny tiny. He weighed 1 pound, and he headed straight to the NICU where they did whatever they needed to do.
How long did he stay in the neonatal intensive care unit?
5 months.
5 months. What was that like? Were you able to pick him up? This is a package of what incredibly small dimensions.
Teeny tiny. Really, the best way to describe his size was he was like a beanie baby, about 10 to 11 inches long. Mm. His head was the size of a tennis ball. His eyes, when he was born, were still fused closed because the skin was, I believe it's all complete. There isn't an opening yet. And his ears were kind of flat because none of the curves had been grown into it. So teeny, teeny, tiny. We couldn't hold him until he was about 28 weeks along. And we just took everything day by day. Our world was just stopped.
I bet. 5 years later, approximately, how is Dexter?
Awesome. He can read a little bit. He can do preliminary math. He's learning to ride a bicycle with training wheels. He loves gymnastics. He's headed to kindergarten.
Developmentally, are there any problems due to that premature birth?
Nothing developmentally. He's on his own schedule. He did get knocked back. So I think he's more like a kiddo who might be a year younger than he actually is, but he's hitting all the milestones just at his own pace.
Hmm. If you just joined us, Tundi Brady is with me, a resident of the Iowa City area, and about 5 years ago she delivered one of the two twins. Very sorry for the passing of your other child there. 5 years ago, one did live, Dexter, and we're talking today about advances in a premature baby birth and a new study. Tundi, stay with us. I want to turn to Dr. Edward Bell. And as we mentioned at the outset of this program, he's an author, one of the researchers involved in a new study that has documented that a small number of very premature babies are surviving outside the womb earlier than doctors once thought possible. Dr. Bell, you're sitting next to Tunde here listening to that story, and it's really an interesting story because it demonstrates some of the things that we're wrestling with as we look at the results of your study. Give us a quick summary of your study's findings.
Okay. I want to just mention briefly that this is the work of a large group of collaborators from the Neonatal Research Network, which is a group of academic newborn care units around the country. And the first author was Matt Rashavi, who at the time was a medical student. As of last Friday, he's now a doctor. But this was a study to try to look at the difference between hospitals in how they approach the care of babies at this threshold of viability. Tunde's babies were just at the margin of viability. One baby was just a little bit too early, and one was just barely far enough along to survive. And we were interested in looking at the difference from hospital to hospital and the rate at which active treatment is provided for babies like this. So we looked at 24 hospitals that belonged to this network and found that at 22 weeks, which is the earliest gestational age at which survival is possible, that there were a number of hospitals. I think there were four hospitals at which no babies were actively treated, and there were five or six hospitals at which all babies were actively treated. At 23 weeks, there was still a very wide range. There were no hospitals where no babies were treated, but there were quite a few babies at which all hospitals were treated. Overall, at 22 weeks, about only one-fourth of the babies were treated. By 23 weeks, overall, about two-thirds were treated. By 24, 25, and 26 weeks, almost all the babies were treated at all the hospitals. But we found this quite interesting, and of course, as you might guess, there were differences in the survival rates from hospital to hospital, and the difference in survival rates correlated with the difference in approach to the babies at these very early gestations.
Mm-hmm. At these various hospitals, and how many institutions did you say you'd studied?
24 hospitals.
24 hospitals across the country. Well, why is there this variance? What did you see as far as factors that made the personnel at these hospitals have such a variance in when they would actively treat a baby and when they would, I believe, provide merely comfort care, expecting the baby to die?
Well, we weren't able to specifically address this from our study because we didn't have this information in our database, but we know from other studies that there are differences in physician attitudes or philosophies. There are differences in hospital policies. There are differences in parental preferences. And all of these probably have a bearing. At these very early gestations, it's an incredibly difficult and complicated decision that's affected by concerns about the terrible dilemma of what to do for these babies that you heard Mrs. Brady express. The chance of survival is not so great. And we haven't talked about it yet, but there is a significant risk of long-term health problems for the babies mm-hmm. that do survive at these very early gestations. And so the decisions have to be made on a case-by-case basis between the doctors and the families. And so it's very hard to say, to make a hard and fast rule. And there have been attempts to do this based strictly on gestational age, but it's a very controversial and provocative issue.
Mm-hmm. And we should mention from the outset, too, that the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics is in a rare among hospitals. It has the ability to treat this this young of a baby. There are only a few of those in the country, right? And those are the ones that you looked at. So I guess another factor would be, is the mother able to get to one of these hospitals. Tunde was, I believe, transferred from another hospital in Iowa City to take advantage of all the care, the additional care that the University of Iowa hospitals could give her.
Yes, it takes great expertise, and it takes a tremendous team and lots of resources to go into the care for babies like this.
Mm-hmm. How much is the family involved in the decision of which type of care a baby should receive when it is on this threshold?
The family is very much a part of the decision, as you heard Tunde describe. We honestly don't know what's the best thing to do for these babies, and since the baby can't speak for herself, we have to let the parents speak on behalf of the baby. Certainly at 22 weeks and even at 23 weeks, we would not presume that active treatment is in the best interest of the baby, but we would engage the family in a discussion, tell them what we know about the chances for a good outcome. Beyond 23 weeks, the results are good enough that we assume that the families are going to want to have the normal intensive care that we would provide to more mature babies.
Mm-hmm. We've used these terms comfort care and active care. Give us some idea of what the difference in those cares are in practice.
Active care is really intensive care, and for very premature babies, they require a lot of support. The most important thing immediately is help with the breathing. So most of these babies will have to place a breathing tube through the mouth into the windpipe and provide some help with breathing, usually by attaching it to an artificial breathing machine. We will ordinarily give some medicine through the tube that will help to replace an important chemical that's not yet present in the lungs of these babies. We'll have to provide artificial means to help keep them warm and to feed them, medicines to help prevent or treat infection. This is more or less the routine sorts of care that we provide in a neonatal intensive care unit. The other babies that we don't actively treat, we provide care for. The focus of the care is different. It's providing for the baby's comfort and the family's comfort and peace of mind.
Mm-hmm. What would that care be like? I mean, Tunde described what she experienced.
Yeah, most important thing is to make sure that the short time that the baby has alive is spent in the loving care of the parents, and want to make sure that the baby is kept warm, and the best way to do that is to have it held by the parents.
Mm-hmm. You talked earlier about this. Let's go into the disabilities that can be connected with premature babies on this threshold, because that is a big part of weighing this. When you communicate to parents, or any doctor communicates about the risks involved with this type of birth, what is said about chances of disabilities and developmental problems?
Well, we communicate that the risks are increased with babies that are born prematurely, and the more premature the baby is, the greater the increase in the risk. But even full-term babies are not immune from these problems. Roughly 10% of babies that are born at full term will have some sort of developmental problem. But we tailor the presentation to the particular family's need for information. Some parents want exact statistics, and some parents just want broader brushstrokes. We will typically discuss the categories of problems that the babies might face. The most important ones are things that affect brain function or potentially vision or hearing. But the babies can also have breathing problems that can last for a few years. The most significant handicaps most people would consider would be problems that make learning more difficult, or can affect ability to walk or to affect coordination or to affect vision or hearing.
Mm-hmm. We have a few minutes before we go to break. I wanted to have you reflect on the impact of this new study that you've observed now over the last few weeks. It's a study that's been out for a few weeks. You are part of the group that has put this out, documenting that if you just joined us, a small number of very premature babies are surviving earlier outside the womb than doctors once thought possible. And there's a variance in depending on where you go to have that baby, that premature baby, on survival rates. So how has and how do you expect this new study to change the nature of the choices faced by doctors and parents about how intensively infants should be treated? What is the impact? It's been out for several weeks and it's been receiving a lot of press around the country and around the world.
Well, I think that's the first thing that we would hope for is that it just generates some awareness and some discussion. I think it's important for patients who might be faced with a very premature delivery to understand that the hospital where they go to deliver may influence the type of care that the baby may receive. I think for doctors and for parents, it's very important to understand the statistics that you're presenting about survival, because for 22-week babies, if you look at all babies born alive, the survival was only 5%. But if you look specifically at the babies that were actively treated, it's 23%. So that's much different. And what most parents want to know is, what are the chances if somebody tries to save my baby, not what are the chances for all babies, including those where nobody tried. And so we want to be sure that the statistics that are presented to parents are the right kinds of statistics.
Mm-hmm. Among these 24 some institutions, had there been sort of discussion between them? You would think that there would be discussion. What is your practice? How do you make these very difficult decisions? Or is this something that will prompt that?
There's been surprisingly little discussion within this network, but there's been more since this paper came out.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And the ethical questions is also something, very briefly, what are the chief ethical questions? We'll get into this in the next half hour that it raises in your mind, Dr. Bell.
I don't see this as a major ethical dilemma. You may be surprised to hear me say that, but perhaps we can get into that more in the next hour, half hour.
Okay, we will do that indeed. Dr. Edward Bell is in our studio in Iowa City, professor of pediatrics in the Steed Family Department of Pediatrics at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, talking about this fascinating new study documenting that a small number of very premature babies are surviving earlier outside the womb than doctors once thought possible. There's a variance in the elite hospitals, 20-some, who can treat these very young infants. A study raising questions about how aggressively they should be treated and other ethical implications. We want to have you join our conversation. Do you have experience with a premature birth? We have Tundi Brady with us. Her child, 5 years ago, was born at just 23 weeks. If you have experience with a premature birth or a question about premature births, join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or find us on Facebook. Back in just a moment with more of this discussion. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We're talking about premature births, the point of viability, a very controversial topic, and a new study that has documented that a small number of very premature babies are surviving earlier outside the womb than doctors once thought possible, and that there's a variance in the way these hospitals are dealing with this. And, you know, 24 hospitals in the country are able to take on a baby that is born prematurely when it's closing in sort of around 20 weeks, 20 to 22 weeks. And we're talking with one of the authors of the new study, Dr. Edward Bell, professor of pediatrics at the Steed Family Department of Pediatrics, the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. We're so happy that Tundi Brady, a resident of Iowa City, is come into our studio to tell us the story of a child of hers that was born at 23 weeks, a little more than 5 years ago. Dexter is in a neighboring studio right next to Tundi, and he's doing well these days. And we heard his story of his birth in the first half hour, and the loss of his twin sister as well, who was lost several days before Dexter was born. Dr. Edward Bell is with us, and we'd like to invite you to join our conversation. Do you have experience with a premature birth? What are your questions about the practice and ethics of premature births? That's what we want to get into this half hour after having learned about this new study in the first half hour. To do that, we're joined by Dr. Loris Kaljan. He is director of the program in bioethics and humanities at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine. Welcome to our studio. Welcome back, I should say, Dr. Kaljan.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
When we talk about these kinds of very difficult decisions, you deal in bioethics. Give us some framework for considering the decisions that we've talked about in the first half hour. When a premature baby should be given one type of more aggressive care in the hopes of having it grow into a healthy individual versus a more passive care to comfort the baby.
The first thing I'd say is I want to express my profound appreciation and respect for the parents of such children and the nurses and the doctors who so dutifully care for these tiniest ones in our society. And to realize that that the pain and the uncertainty that surrounds these moments is incredible to consider, especially for those of us who have not had to go through them. But the next thing I would say is actually, by contrast, a point to say that in a real sense, the decision-making that goes on in these situations is no different than in any other serious medical decision-making moment. And that's where I would say that we need to keep in mind what I call the dimensions of decision-making or dimensions of shared decision-making. And once we know what the diagnosis is and then have our best sense of the prognosis, what the future may or may not hold, then there are three particular dimensions that we need to think about. The first is, what's the goal or the goals of care? The second, what are the probabilities that with a given intervention we can try to achieve that one or more goals? And then thirdly, what's the burden of suffering? How much will it take to bear to go through to try to get to that goal on such and such probabilities? And I won't mention further now, but the question of cost is another issue that you might want to come back to, because I have some specific things to say about that. But so once we know what the situation is, goals, probabilities, and suffering, I think, is really what we're talking about in these kinds of situations.
Mm-hmm. So when we look at this particular study and the variance that we see among these elite hospitals able to care for babies this young, what are the ethical implications that you see?
To me, it's a fascinatingly important example of how science can only do so much for us. There's no textbook that we can find and pull off the shelf or bring up online that's going to give us, quote-unquote, the right answer to what to do. We have remarkable studies now from people like Dr. Bell and his colleagues that give us a lot of really important statistical information. Human beings are still going to have to interpret this and weight it and assess it and decide what beliefs and values they will bring to this interpretation to make sense out of it. And the very fact that you hear both from Mrs. Brady, who said, even in one of her comments, she mentioned that the tone was not very hopeful in the way one of the initial conversations went. That tells you something about the interpretation of those sets of facts. And then likewise, you heard from Dr. Bell, who said that at 22 and 23 weeks, the neonatologists defer very much to the parents and their assessments, their preferences. But at 24 weeks, the neonatologists start to assume that intensive care, active life-sustaining treatment, is what is going to be preferred. So you have all these variabilities going on that depend upon who the neonatologist is, what their assessments are, who the parents are, what their preferences are, and possibly what policies the hospital may have.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like we have a spectrum, and of course, depending on the doctor as well, and depending on where the baby is in its development, that you have may starts off when it's very, very premature, a gloomy assessment, on into a neutral assessment, and then in, as it's older, a more positive assessment. And this is communicated to—so what I'm saying is that doctors cannot just be neutral.
I completely agree. I don't think there is any neutral ground, even though I think some physicians are better at this than others. So okay. There is, and so people can try to the best of their professional ability to try to give the facts as they understand them. But even the tone of voice that is used, which details are given, Dr. Bell reminds us that good clinicians learn to give more detailed information to patients and parents who want more. Others tend to be using more broad strokes. But we even heard the figure 23% chance of survival amongst those 22-week premature babies. That 23%, how do we describe that to someone? What does 23% mean? Do you say, well, about 1 out of 5? Or do you say that 4 out of 5 won't survive? Which way do I choose to say that, and what might be the undertones of that message?
You mentioned what I'll call the three legs of the picture here, the care, where that care is going, the probability of success, the suffering. You mentioned cost as well. Come back to that. But what about the idea of disability, premature? How should that figure into the ethical decision, the decision-making of the parent together with the doctor?
It's profoundly important. And it also sometimes gets tagged under the rubric of so-called quality of life. That phrase gets used a lot in healthcare and I think in society. And anyone who uses it, I think, really has the burden of explaining what they mean by it, because it has things to do with physical realities, emotional, social, spiritual, whole sets of what it is to exist as a human being that are entirely challenging to predict. And I was even reminded in reviewing some of the literature around these discussions that some people make reference to something that's known in the literature as the disability paradox, that if you actually get self-reports, for instance, from adolescents or young adults who were themselves preterm babies, that their self-reports of the value of their own life experiences actually is higher than the so-called objective measures of quality of life and function that professionals might attribute to them.
Mm. So what does that tell you as an ethicist?
It tells me that we are all bringing our values and beliefs to these realities, and each of us will assess them differently. And there isn't a one-to-one correlation between how much disability someone has and how rich their lives are.
Mm. Dexter has seemingly no disabilities. Tundi Brady, your approximately 5-year-old boy here who survived a premature birth, was that on your mind and your husband's mind at the time of the birth? Was that put out there as a something to factor in? And how was it put into the equation?
It was. I think I remember that we were told statistics that there at his where he was in that 23rd week at that time, that he could, if he survived, he had a 70% chance of having a severe disability. And so my husband and I expected that he would. But as we thought about that, and at the time, I do have to say, we were grieving the loss of our daughter just a few days earlier, so we were just in emotional upheaval. But as Dr. Kaljan just mentioned, what he just talked about, that went through our mind too, that the disabilities were possible blindness, deafness, cerebral palsy. And in my mind, are ours, you know, whether we're right or wrong, blindness and deafness didn't seem like a huge disability. There's incredible things a person could do and to contribute to society and live a very, very, very full life with those disabilities. And cerebral palsy, in the same way, that was something I actually didn't understand what that even was at the time. But so those things did cross our minds, but I think we thought, how whatever gift our son comes with, we will just work with him so that he gets to have the best life and to contribute to our world just as the rest of us do.
Dr. Kaljan, you mentioned cost. Let's come back to that. How should that ethically be figured in? How is it figured in?
It's a fascinating question. And the first thing that I would say as a physician myself is that I know that there are controversies in our society, especially right now these days, given the cost of healthcare across society. I believe that physicians and nurses should not be the ones expected to manage costs. That's the first thing I'd say. Someone in society needs to do this. These are extremely important things. We have to run a reasonable budget in healthcare. But we don't want to cause a given physician to have to say, on the one hand, I want to represent my patient's interests. On the other hand, I need to represent the economy's interests. So we need to separate those roles. The second thing I would say, though, and Dr. Bell can very much, I'm sure, speak to these really interesting details, is that if you look at how much it costs to help one of these preterm infants live, and that the investment of that amount of money based on, in light of how many years they go on to live, the actual value as designated by this curious term called a QALY, Q-A-L-Y, quality adjusted life year, is actually very good value. And compared to many interventions that are given to adult patients, it's much better. So if you really want to play the economics assessment and calculation, you need to look at the facts and then say, well, perhaps it's actually much more different than our intuitions, uninformed, might have led us to believe.
We know cost practically has to be part of the picture, but as an ethicist or someone, it's hard to put that. You're putting a cost on life, aren't you, Dr. Bell, or in some form doing that necessarily. But this is what doctors do.
Well, yes, but as Dr. Kaljian said, there are few better investments in healthcare than treating a very premature baby. We spend about $3 billion a year for the care of all of these babies of 22 through 26 weeks in the U.S. That's a lot of money, but when you look at what we spend on other things, we spend about five times that much on pet food and about seven times that much on tobacco advertising. So we're a very wealthy society, and we've got the money. We just have to establish the priorities and make some choices. As Dr. Kaljian said, the cost of saving a baby like this is high because, not so much because the cost per day is high, but because the baby stays in the hospital for a long time, because you have to keep him in the hospital until roughly around the time he was supposed to be born. So Dexter was in the hospital for 5 months, and so that runs up a big bill. But then if you consider that he's got 80 or 90 years of good life to contribute to society, and you divide the cost by the number of years, the cost per life year or per quality adjusted life year is not so bad. 20 years ago, Dr. John Tyson did an analysis and found the cost of saving a 500-gram baby, that's about a one-pound baby, was $12,000 per cost per quality adjusted life year, compared to an elderly patient in the last year of life, that's about $180,000, and an adult with cancer is about $100,000, and an adult with leukemia is about $500,000. So the preemie is a very good investment.
Let me share with you this comment tagged on to an NPR article about this topic. Just have you react to it. Perhaps you have some other comments. JC online commented, I've had far more dear friends who have blown through $500,000 insurance to save their child who was born too soon. And at the end of the day, there just isn't enough money and there never will be. He goes on to say, just as we are coming to the realization that the end of life shouldn't be all about sustaining no matter what the quality, I wish we as a society would come to grips with the same principle at the beginning of life. I wish we could be less obsessed with saving every child, no matter what the cost, and I don't mean just money. How do you react to those thoughts by JC?
They are a reflection of the values and beliefs that he has about what is a life worth living and what is a society worth living, and I think, frankly, about these questions of probabilities and suffering. So I would say that he is someone who would look at 23% and then look at the risks of major disabilities and say, it's not worth it. But that is actually a statement of something he believes, meaning a statement of faith. There's no science that's going to answer that question. And once again, I completely agree that people have to manage budgets in society. Insurance companies have to decide what they're going to reimburse. But let's separate and have a division of labor on those questions. And in a healthy democracy, let's have good debates about that. But at the level of the doctor-patient, doctor-parent relationship, let's protect that space so that there can be a genuine shared decision-making. And given the resources and technologies we have, at least in some centers, let's be thankful for all the good that is happening in that regard.
You mentioned democracy feeding right into the what we wanted to spend a few minutes, the remaining 5 minutes of the program, talking about. Certainly, this study has a political dimension, will be put to use for purposes in the abortion debate in this country. I want to ask each of you doctors how you view this. The Supreme Court has said that states must allow abortion if a fetus is not viable outside the womb. Do you think that changing that standard could therefore raise some questions about when abortion is legal? Dr. Bell, can you have a first reaction to that?
I'm a baby doctor. I'm not a politician, so I really don't care to comment on that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Dr. Calgin.
I think to the extent, I think those who are lawyers in our society will be expert on these questions that are judicial. But to the extent that the Supreme Court's original decision in 1973 was in large part, of course, based on biological and biomedical facts, if those facts are changing, we would also expect law to reflect that reality. That to me is just common sense, rational approach to running a democracy. So that simply has to play out as it will in our democratic procedures. I think what also is coming up here, though, is that there are questions about attitudes towards preterm human life. And there's a colleague of Dr. Bell's named Dr. Annie Janvier from the University of Montreal, who has done some work where they actually give scenarios to physicians to say, where would you think it's worth spending more life-sustaining effort when you compare, say, a 24-week preterm infant versus, say, a 2-month-old normally timed born child who has meningitis? And she would give them the exact same prognosis, but there would be more interest in supporting the 2-month-old with meningitis than the preterm baby. So we should ask ourselves about our attitudes towards prenatal life and have straightforward conversations about that.
Mm. Straightforward conversations and politics, I don't know if they go together, but we'll take that. I understand your response there, Dr. Calgin. What is, Dr. Bell, what is a follow-up to this? Where does this study lead us to as far as future research? What questions does it raise or emphasize in this area?
Well, we have some interesting follow-up studies already underway. We're looking at an analogous study looking specifically at the hospital differences in obstetrical approach to these very preterm pregnancies. In our study, we looked just at the differences in the active treatment from the pediatric side, but just as important or even more important is the obstetrician's approach to this, because perhaps the single most important medical intervention to give these babies a chance is in the hands of the obstetricians, and that's to give the mother steroid treatments. So that, from a research standpoint, that's the next step for us.
Mm-hmm. Any unexpected reactions to this study, which has received press widely around the country and around the world, that you didn't actually figure into it?
Well, I didn't honestly anticipate the impact on the abortion debate, but I guess I should have.
Mm, okay. Let's finish up. Tundi Brady, you've been with us listening to this whole conversation, of course, at the beginning, sharing your story of giving birth to a child of 23 weeks. Are there any lingering thoughts that stay with you now 5 years after this ordeal of losing one of your twins and thankfully having Dexter with you today, actually, in the neighboring studio?
Oh, lingering thoughts. So, you know, we'll always miss our daughter and lament that she didn't get to join her brother. our minds know that we made the right decision for her. Our hearts always wonder now that these studies are coming out and technology has moved us forward and younger children are being able to be saved, that, you know, what if she could have made it?
And you've experienced through this ordeal the premature babies, there's a lot that goes into the viability of a baby. And perhaps that's a misconception in our society, that people don't understand that because they don't have to, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a day-by-day experience in the NICU. They're so fragile, and it's a huge roller coaster, and it's an emotional roller coaster for the parents.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for having the courage to come in and tell us about your firsthand experience. Tundi Brady, I can see through the studio window. Dexter is waiting to be back in your arms, and Claire, our producer, is smiling there. She'll have to give him up. Dr. Edward Bell, thank you as well, professor of pediatrics at the Steed Family Department of Pediatrics at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Also, Dr. Loris Kaljan, director of the program in bioethics and humanities at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine. Thank you all for coming in for this discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ben.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Join us again tomorrow. It's a News Buzz Friday. Thanks for joining us. I'm Ben Kiefer.